All right, here we go. So yeah, there's no transition or anything. Now you've got your second speaker, Chris Turner. I'd like to say, first of all, thank you, John, for that fantastic large-scale, gigaton-scale look at the scale of the problem we're facing. I'll be taking it now much more down to street level before I get into the bigger problems. But first, I wanted to say, first, thank you to McGill University and Ecole Polytechnique for hosting this event and for inviting me to be a part of it. Thanks as well to Laurent Trottier for making the gift that created these institutes and for pointing it at the defining issue of the 21st century, which is how we get from this unsustainable track that we are onto a sustainable track. Really just exactly where we need to be putting our best and brightest minds. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about this evening, is how do we make that jump, that leap, particularly when it comes down to cities. And the reason why it's an urban leap, and by the way, urban, I mean urban as in not rural. I don't necessarily mean big bustling downtowns, anything larger than a village. The basic principles of urban sustainability hold. But in any case, why the urban leap? Why is that so important? Comes back to actually something that John mentioned when he said, you know, what we need to do is get, you know, engineers, designers, the best and brightest, tasked with the job of fixing these problems, getting us from that unsustainable track to a sustainable one. And it's worth pausing to realize that we got onto this unsustainable track because we tasked the best and brightest minds to do all the stuff that we're currently doing that's unsustainable. And we did that not because we had a giant meeting 100 years ago and said, hey, you know what we need to do is you guys go off and build coal-fired power plants that are going to, you know, create climate change, and you guys go off and design cul-de-sacs and long looping boulevards so that everyone has to have a car and drive all over the place. What happened was we didn't do that. We fell in love with a story of how to live for really good reasons. And then created the demand that was then filled by all of these machines and technologies and design strategies and assumptions that are now failing us. And so I do want to begin with the story. And one kind of story, particularly if you're talking to a business crowd, is a value proposition. Value proposition is that sort of the story of here's the thing I'm trying to sell you and why it's useful to you. Here's the thing that this does, this package or this item or this service that nothing else could do for you. And what we need to do is get that value proposition for cities just right. Before we think about, we do have to solve megaton and gigaton and gigawatt problems, but before we get there, we got to get that story right. And so that's why I wanted to start with story. As many of you probably know, we are in the first urban century. Over half the planet population now lives in cities. By 2050 or so, by which point we need to have a lot of this stuff solved, something like 80% of us are going to live in cities. So we are solving this problem for the places where we live and work and use all the energy that we need, which are cities. So what was the value proposition that led to the birth of the sort of modern city to begin with? Let's kind of go through these, and then it kind of points to where we need to go. Well, here is that original value proposition. This is a street scene in the Lower East Side of New York City around the turn of the century. And this was the value proposition that kind of, among other things, made North America one of the most prosperous regions, the most prosperous region really actually on Earth, and certainly made our cities great. And this was, you know, particularly in retrospect, there was a certain sort of Dickensian thing to this. This is a very obviously dense and dirty and somewhat maddening scene. But the reason there are all these people clamoring to be there is because there was a value proposition to this edition of the city, this sort of first industrial city, that nothing else could offer. If you were, wherever you were on Earth, you knew you could get to one of these places, you could make your way. You had chances of social mobility that nowhere else on Earth could offer. Chances of economic opportunity. You can see there is so much economic opportunity in this scene that it nearly crowds everything else up. People have carts on the road. People are moving goods to and forth. This is a scene of an exploding, vibrant, incredibly prosperous and growing city. And so this was, you know, for that first phase of industrial growth, this was a tremendous value proposition. But in time, of course, that Dickensian stuff did kind of begin to outweigh the benefit. The cost started to outweigh the benefits. The cons started to outweigh the pros. There was, you know, disease and dirtiness and, you know, read a description of a 19th century city. It was a very, very smelly, dirty place. And so, of course, we came up with the next great sort of urban value proposition. And it took a little while to unfold, but it basically came down to this. You want your own space. You want some room around, some green space that's your own, that your family can grow in. You're going to want a car that, which brings you unlimited social mobility, or physical mobility, actually, of a sort that you've never been able to imagine. Every single one of us will live on our own little manor, our own little estate. We will all be kings of the castle on one of these wonderful little suburban streets. This is, of course, what I think of as the ultimate in 20th century urban design, the cul-de-sac, the street that's designed to not take you from anywhere to anywhere, but just to end at the place where you call home, and was the apex of that suburban value proposition. And we built the most energy-intensive society humanity's ever seen, this incredibly wasteful society we live in, to feed this dream, whether we called it the American dream or the good life or, you know, just where we wanted to be as a prosperous middle-class society. This was what we were shooting for. And what's happening now is the same thing that happened to cities, you know, as we came into the 20th century, which is that all of the value in this proposition is beginning to decrease and all of the costs are beginning to outweigh the benefits. Climate change being the biggest one, of course. But even if you look at attitudes toward the kind of communities we want to live in. Are we saying, yes, we all want to live on cul-de-sacs with a two-car garage? More and more, particularly in younger demographics, we're saying, no, we want to live in a vibrant place where we can walk around, where we maybe don't have to get into a car to get to work, that sort of thing. And so that brings us to the value proposition today for a city in Canada in the 21st century. And particularly for, you know, I did want to sort of acknowledge for a city like Montreal, there's lots of great work that's already been done. A lot of it actually before we got around to that sort of suburban model, which is that you've still got the great old bones of a sustainable urban model that didn't require as much energy as it does today. This is a great example of it, of course. This is, you know, a main street in the Plateau neighborhood, not far from here. And you've already got, particularly here in Montreal, a whole bunch of advantages. You have one of the probably Canada's best downtown in terms of, you know, being able to live near where you work, get around by transit or other modes of conveyance, that sort of thing. In fact, on the island of Montreal, 46% of commuters, this is just one number to throw at it, 46% of commuters don't need a car and don't use a car to get about their daily needs, and that's the highest of any downtown in Canada. You're also fed by a pretty green grid. Now, we could argue the merits of large hydro versus distributed energy, and I'm going to, but to begin with, your carbon footprint's already way smaller. So in some cases, from some angles, you could look at this picture and say, hey, you know what, Montreal kind of already got the model built there, and we can, you know, just kind of improve on the strengths we already have. But I wanted to sort of pause there for a minute and go back to the poster child for the unsustainable model and kind of talk about how Montreal is actually, you know, very much in the same boat as any North American city is. This is, of course, the picture of the problem. I chose to pick on my hometown of Calgary because I figure no one's going to knock me for picking on my own hometown. This is what North Calgary looks like. As a matter of fact, this is what the most recent development in almost every city in North America looks like. This is not unique to Calgary, even though it's much more visible in the environment in Calgary because it's a very flat space and the rest of it. And so if you move beyond just the island of Montreal, this is just to put a single number on it. We could look at all the different metrics, but just to look at that commuter metric, one of the things we're talking about is how do we get, you know, meet our daily needs with less energy. One of those is to not have to use a car for every single one of our errands and to get to work and the rest of it. So compare not the downtown of Calgary and the downtown of Montreal, but the census metropolitan areas of the two. And admittedly, Calgary, census metropolitan area, 77% of the people going about their daily commute are in a car, a private vehicle of one sort or another. But the figure for the census metropolitan area of Montreal is 70%, which really is a statistical hiccup from the long-term sustainability goals. Every single one of our cities is facing the exact same problems of car dependency, carbon footprints grown too big, and the rest of it. None of us have this licked. And as I said off the top, none of this happened by accident, even if it turned into a mess. It was to fill that dream. And really, before I get into how energy is made, let's talk about how it's used. And the way it's used, again, comes back to that story, that good life that we're all leading. And one of the ways we articulate that story is by urban design, by the way we build our streets. What you're looking at is Deerfoot Trail, which is the main north-south commuter artery in Calgary, but it is, at base, a street. That's what it is. It is a public street for public use. And over the course of the last half century or so, this is how we've built more and more of our streets, and every single day have told every single Canadian who lives in one of these communities, the best use of your city, the best use of these public conveyances, this public space called the street, is to get in a private vehicle and go from one private space to another. We've said that in every single thing we've done in designing our communities, almost every single thing over the last half century. And so the fact that Deerfoot Trail in Calgary, where I'm from, looks like this every day is in no way an accident. These people are doing exactly what the story told them was the thing to do, and it looked like a really, really attractive option until it got to this point. This isn't even a bad day. This is what it looks like every day. A single car having an engine fail on this road during that period of time, and this is total chaos and spills over into a whole bunch of other streets and roads and just makes a mess of things all over the place. So how do we begin to solve this? We begin to solve this by recognizing how deeply this story has infected our thinking about what cities are, what public space is. And I'm going to give you an extreme example of that. Again, picking on my hometown of Calgary, but I don't think we're unique in this. But just because it's such an egregious example of careless car-centered design that has led to not only the car dependency stuff and the rest of it, but a significant negative impact on quality of life. Part of the reason why this value proposition is failing. What you're looking at here is the entrance to the main entrance, the entrance the vast majority of people arriving at Alberta Children's Hospital in Calgary use to get to the hospital itself. Alberta Children's Hospital is a magnificent, beautiful, fairly new structure, was built, with a very, very lavish budget. Once you get in that door, there are big, wide, colorful hallways. There's a grand piano next to the cafeteria for kids to play with. There's a fantastic aquarium. It's a wonderful place to be a kid. But in the process of building this, hundreds of millions of dollars went into this. God knows how many stakeholder meetings, how many different people got to look at the plans and have their priorities met and the rest of it. And at no point did anyone think, what happens when a blind kid, a kid with mobility issues, a sick kid, a worried parent, even just a kid in a stroller, leaves that entrance and enters the parking lot? Because this is now an incredibly dangerous, treacherous place to be a kid, not in a car. And at no point did we think to ourselves, hey, what about when they stop the car and get out and go to the, it didn't even enter into it. All we looked at is how can we maximize the number of parking spots in that space? How do we have to build it for the most economical cost? Even places where, even if they aren't welcoming spaces, would be not bad spaces for a kid in a wheelchair, for example. We've actually put up barriers because it's more important to tell the cars where to go than to make safe space for kids, even in a parking lot at a children's hospital. This is how deeply this car-centered, anti-people design has infected the way we build our cities. And we need to reverse that. And I'd like to look at how we begin that conversation, that story about reversing it, and then get into the really great value proposition that is emerging from solving some of these problems. And I'll begin by looking at the sort of state of the art. If this is as bad as it gets, building children's hospital parking lots that don't even function for sick kids, what's the state of the art? What's the world's most livable, most sustainable city? There are arguments to be made for a bunch of them. One of the cities, the one I know best, that is perennially at the top of the world list of most sustainable cities is this one, the city of Copenhagen, capital of Denmark. Copenhagen, just to put a number on it in terms of sustainability, the average resident of Copenhagen has a carbon footprint 80% smaller than the average resident of a Canadian city. So clearly, most of the way there to a low-carbon, sustainable future, and have also along the way built one of the world's liveliest and most welcoming cities, a city that's just wonderful fun to be in. How did they get there? This is the instructive part, the story here, because it's a story we are all telling ourselves already in Canadian cities. Copenhagen just had the argument earlier and found the better answer to it earlier. And the story in Copenhagen begins in the late 1950s when, as an old European capital with a medieval downtown, it saw serious car traffic for the first time. And because the downtown was built to those old medieval specifications, it didn't take very long for cars to fill it up. And what you're looking at right here is the Strøget, which is the main shopping street in downtown Copenhagen. In the late 1950s, as you can see, people crowded onto these narrow little sidewalks. Copenhagen's always been a city of cyclists, but there were proposals that maybe bikes needed to be banned from the inner city because they were getting in the way of the vehicles. How to solve this? It's a bottleneck everywhere. What do we do to fix this problem? Copenhagen, alone at the time, among among cities decided to do the opposite of getting everything out of the way of the cars. And they said, actually, let's just take the cars away and give that space back to the people. And so the very first thing they did, starting in 1962, was pedestrianize their main street, that Stroit, that main downtown block. And it's worth pausing to underscore that in 1962 in Copenhagen, even though car culture had only had about 10 or 15 years, really, since the end of World War II to really kind of deeply ingrain itself, this was an enormously unpopular measure that was seen as courting disaster. Some of the businesses on this street closed shop and moved onto side streets because they were so convinced you could not possibly have a successful business if people couldn't drive their cars to it. Regular, you know, just sort of average Copenhageners, they didn't think this was a good idea. The sort of slogan of the time was, you know, we are not Italians. This is not our culture. We don't sit out at cafes. You know, it's cold and dark here for half the year. My take on this is, you know, who's the most famous Dane? It's Hamlet, who sits inside wondering whether it's even worth going on. We don't sit out at cafes. That's not what we do. But, of course, what happened, and the great urban design guru Jan Gehl, who's sort of the great evangelist of the Copenhagen model, likes to say, cultures are different all over the world, but people are all the same. They will sit outside and spend time with each other if you give them great places to do it. And the integrity of the public space was the first big piece of Copenhagen's sustainability model. They weren't even aiming for sustainability at the time because the term didn't exist, but they recognized that this thing that they had done by getting the cars out of the way of the people just made lives better. And so they expanded it. It's now Europe's biggest downtown pedestrian network, block by block, square by square. The square you're looking at right here was essentially a parking lot until about 30 years ago when it was given back over. And as you can see, Danes, just like Italians, just like Canadians, like to sit out and spend time with other people, particularly actually in northern cultures where we are forced inside for part of the year. The picture you're looking at right here is kind of a chilly day in May. And a chilly day in May in Copenhagen, even though the temperature's about freezing, still has a real bite to it. It's such a maritime climate. And people are happy to sit out. One of the things that the Copenhagen cafe owners do is they put out these fleece blankets for you to use. They're mainly sponsored by the beer company, so they have like a Tuborg or a Carlsberg logo on them. And you just sit there wrapped in your blanket and finally soak up a little sunshine at the end of a long winter. And what's happened along the way of getting the cars out of the way is that not only did they figure out that people like the space, but you could do a lot more with urban space if you hadn't given it entirely over to cars. And this is something that certainly here in Montreal that there have been some really, really great measures doing, things like creating actual space for other forms of transit. Copenhagen has a great public transit system as well, trains and the rest of it, and I'll come to that. But one of the things that it's most admired for is how well they do bike culture. 35% of the city of Copenhagen's population, more than 50% of downtown residents, do their daily commute primarily by bicycle. And it's not just that Danes have always been on bikes and they were born on bikes or whatever else. It's that look at the infrastructure they've been built, they've been given to do it in. This is an actual bike lane. There's a few of them here, but there's not many in Canada yet. It's distinguished by a couple of things that we don't see a lot of in cycling culture in North America yet. Notice there's a slight curb there, so the bikes definitely know where their space is versus the car's space. We're coming up to a very busy, very dangerous intersection, so there's a physical barrier between the cars and the bikes. That was put there expressly to give the bike people on the bikes a sense of comfort and safety, because what happens if you build bike lanes right is, as you can see, cyclists no longer feel the need to dress as if for some sort of gladiatorial competition. They no longer need to put on special gear, as you can see. They're not riding bikes that were designed to go straight down hills in the wilderness. They're just people going about their daily business. And so great lesson there. If you build the public space right, if you get those sort of design details right, tell the story not of how to move cars and what's the throughput on that street, but what is a street for? What is that public space for? And you quickly come to this fantastic model, and it's been so successful in the inner city of Copenhagen that it's spread around the world, but among other places, has spread even to suburban environments in Copenhagen. This is where, if you take one of the commuter trains right to the end of the line, which I had to do for a meeting, and usually when I do that in a city, and I will stubbornly do that sometimes, and I'll look at Google Maps, I'll be like, well, it looks like it's only a kilometer once I get to the other end, and then you wind up traversing like three parking lots, and you feel like you're trespassing, and it's just awful. In Copenhagen, they've actually done a great job of that last mile, as urban planners like to call it. You can leave your bike at the train station and ride it into your office park. This is one of the few office parks I'd ever been to that actually had justified the name park. It actually was sort of a welcoming environment. So this is what that sort of sustainable model looks like. And it really did not begin from how is it do we live in a much more constrained sort of energy environment. The rest of it was what kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of city do we want to live in? And it wound up solving a whole bunch of the sustainability problems along the way. This is a conversation we've already begun in North America. It looks slightly different here because the scale and the design problem were very, very different. But we have begun to say, city by city, block by block, hey, let's rethink what the city should look like. And one of the kind of first lines in the sand, as it were, in this discussion is this community in South Florida. This is the community of Seaside, which was the very first neighborhood built to what became known as the New Urbanism specifications. This is Andres Dueñas' first big project in Florida. And what's remarkable about it, a lot of the attention when the New Urbanism first got going in the 1980s was that it looked kind of, it was a lot of the buildings were sort of intentionally throwback buildings. It looked kind of like a Hollywood set, so much so, in fact, that the movie The Truman Show was filmed in Seaside, Florida, because it looked more like a Hollywood set than any Hollywood set they could build, which, fair enough, but what really matters to this conversation is look at the rethink of what a street is. Think of what a suburban street, which is built to be safe at 80 kilometers an hour in a car, is versus this. This, even if you, and I can attest to it, cars are allowed. If you drive down this at anything faster than about 20, 25 kilometers an hour, you'll feel like a maniac. Everything about the design is there to tell you, this is not just for you. There are going to be people in this street. There are going to be people near this street. Slow down. You can still take your car where you need to go, but you are not the priority here. And, of course, what happens when you do that, and you see this in Seaside, Florida, there's touch football games in the street. Kids set up lemonade stands. People linger and talk to their neighbors on the street corner. All that stuff that used to just happen as an incidental product of how you build a city, we now have to design back in. And we've been doing that now for a generation, and we've learned some lessons about what new urbanism works and what doesn't. And we've seen some great success stories. This is one of the grandest, I think, of the first generation of new urbanism. This is Belmar, which is the downtown, the new downtown for Lakewood, Colorado, which is a suburb of Denver. And remarkable because Lakewood was a suburb. It had no downtown. And so the scene you're looking at, which in many ways is just how we built all downtowns before cars came along, what makes it most remarkable is that this scene you're looking at right here 10 years ago was the parking lot of a dying shopping mall. And that's the really great thing, transformative kind of narrative about Lakewood is they didn't say how do we make the shopping mall more efficient or slightly more sustainable. They said, well, how do we build a whole city that we want to live in and that people are going to be drawn to? And they realized we need a downtown. Cities need a downtown, and so they built one. Now, this is great if you've got the right people in charge, as they did in Lakewood, and you've got a budget for a 15-year build that's going to cost a couple of billion dollars and the rest of it. It's a great catalyst for change. But, of course, lots of the stuff that we need to do to fix our cities is not going to have that luxury. We do have, I mean, certainly here in Montreal, you have some huge infrastructure projects going on. But still, those things tend to be pointed at the old problem and making the old problem slightly less bad. Things like, refurbishing bridges that we didn't build terribly well the first time and that sort of thing. So what if you don't have that kind of timeline? What if you, in your community, want to be, getting involved in this before the giant, new urbanist build comes along? And this is where the second wave of new urbanism, what's being called more and more tactical urbanism, has come along in just the last few years and really is, I think, one of the most exciting places, not because they're changing overnight the gigaton problem, but because they are a catalyst to start a conversation and write a story that we are all going to want to be a part of. And so let me take you through the kind of short history of tactical urbanism and why I think it's such a transformative social and design movement. It began all over the place in scattered pockets and corners with sort of interventions on the urban landscape. This is one of the more famous ones. This is one of the installations for Parking Day in San Francisco. And what Parking Day was initially an unsanctioned, illegal intervention on the urban landscape to reclaim, just for a day, a handful of parking spaces all throughout the city to demonstrate, just for one day, how much more we could be doing with that public space, how much more we could build into the neighborhoods we have so that everyone doesn't feel obliged to get into their car and go somewhere else to meet their daily needs. And it started, as you can see, quite simply, this is an old dumpster that someone turned into a little mini park for a day. And it was so successful that the city of San Francisco eventually decided, hey, let's sanction this, let's make it part of our urban design toolkit. And so you now see, much more sort of carefully and stylishly designed stuff, but demonstrating the exact same point, that any given parking spot or two anywhere in the city could be so much more than just a place for cars to be left while people go about their daily needs. Not to say that there aren't still cars in the place, but again, that they shouldn't be the absolute highest priority in every single design decision. This toolkit, this sort of new urban, tactical urbanist toolkit, comes in many shapes and sizes, works pretty much the same everywhere you do it. This is an example from Halifax, Nova Scotia. This is Argyle Street, the big kind of cafe and restaurant and bar street in Halifax, roughly equivalent to Crescent Street here in Montreal. And what they do during the summer months is they put this temporary sidewalk, take a bunch of, you know, it's about a half dozen parking spots, put down a temporary sidewalk, and they buy back a bunch of space for people to be in. Incidentally, there's still some design craziness going on here. We do this in far too many Canadian cities. You see this ridiculous fence here. This is just zoning. I just mentioned this as a side note. One of the things we do is overregulate urban environments. Every single city in Europe manages to have cafes without physical barriers between them and the street, without people wantonly drinking down the road or whatever is thought to be caged in by that fence. Anyway, that's a pet peeve of mine and a side note. Obviously, the toolkit works, and where it gets really exciting is if you can put a bunch of these together and build what's called a complete street and demonstrate to a community just how valuable that public space can be. And the really extraordinary story that sort of began this, you know, the tactical urbanist version of the complete street anyway, begins with one of those typical, derelict, falling down on its luck kind of districts and the main street, or the former main street that ran through it. This is a neighborhood called Oak Cliff in Dallas, Texas. Very typical of that era. It was a streetcar suburb if you went far enough back. It had streetcars servicing it prior to World War II. After World War II, they pulled out the streetcar lines. It turned into a very car-oriented suburb. And then, in part because of a huge neighborhood dispute over forced integration of the schools and busing and that sort of thing in Dallas, basically there was sort of a white flight. It became, you know, a very, very poor, high-crime kind of neighborhood through the 80s and 90s. But then what happened just in the last 10 years or so is it still had some great old urban bones, as they say. You can see the, you know, old storefronts and a nice little streetscape. But what had happened in the intervening years was that, you know, the city had done everything it could to make this street fail, not only giving most of it over to high-speed traffic, but also zoning it with no kind of sense of scale or use at all. When the bike shop first and the little bookstore first opened on this strip, you could only open shops on the one side of the road, the right side of the road, because the other side was zoned for some reason commercial industrial, so you could not have a retail establishment on the other side of the road. The parking requirements were crazy. There was no way to kind of meet them and have a successful business. But anyway, this little business revitalization group got together, and they started talking about what can we do for Oak Cliff. And they knew if we went down to City Hall and said, hey, you know what we'd like to do actually is paint the bike lane on and put in some street trees and some cafe seating, and we'd like to, you know, totally actually, you know, shrink the entire roadway by two lanes and the rest of it. They knew no way they're going to get that in Dallas, Texas. They're not going to get that through. So what they did was they got a permit to have a festival, an art festival, and the central kind of art installation of the festival was something called the Better Block. And this is what it looked like. So basically, the art installation was a functional streetscape. And they did this for less than $1,000 without a single professional designer involved. It was just basically, you know, people's sweat, donated materials. You can see cheap cafe seating, donated trees that you could take up at the end of the day. They painted the bike lanes on themselves and dramatically changed the conversation in their community about what a street should be. And you can see that's the before and after. That's the exact same block. And that's what you can do through this sort of better block phenomenon and through this tactical urbanist phenomenon. Again, all by itself, this doesn't fix the bigger problems that we are looking at long term. What it does, though, for this community is completely stand the whole conversation on its head. We are no longer talking about how do we get by with less, how do we reduce our carbon footprint. We're saying, how do we make our streets work better? How do we build a more vibrant community? How do we get more excited about living in this fantastic urban environment? And it's a really, really exciting thing, so much so, and this is very much sort of a millennial generation kind of thing. Of course, it was documented meticulously. They threw it up on YouTube. It's a fantastic little video that you can watch, and there's barely any dialogue in it. You just watch it unfold, and they explain how they did it, and it quickly went viral, as they say, spreading to cities across the United States. This is all just in the last 2 years. You can see there's a flyer for a better block project in Fort Lauderdale. The upper right picture is Oklahoma City. The lower right is Wichita, Kansas. Do note that I am not talking about the, you know, we're no longer talking about San Francisco, some, you know, hip, upscale, booming little urban enclave. We're talking about, you know, Midwestern cities with some pretty chronic car dependency problems, seeing these interventions, even just for a couple of days. And what they're allowing, what they're setting the stage for is that bigger conversation about how do we then build everything else that we need in this city to be sustainable in the 21st century. And the great thing about that is, of course, that some of those tools are already there or soon emerging to do some really, really amazing stuff in terms of the design of our cities, the smart design of our cities, to use an overused term. I had an opportunity last year to go to the C40 Climate Awards in London, England. C40 is the 40 big city mayors who got together, starting with Michael Bloomberg and Boris Johnson from London and a few others, and basically are trading best sustainability practices. And there's two things that have emerged out of that conversation. One is that cities are leading this conversation from a governmental point of view. Without a doubt, the most innovative stuff is happening at the municipal level. And then two, that they didn't want to sit around and wait for some sort of big top-down solution. They wanted to get stuff built now. It was at this fantastic facility, and that's the reason I'm showing you this picture. This is the Siemens crystal built by the huge industrial giant, German industrial giant Siemens on the docklands on the Thames in London. And why would Siemens build this giant thing on the docklands in London? Basically because Siemens has bet a big chunk of its company on the idea that we need to completely overhaul the infrastructure of our cities. We need to do it in a sustainable manner, predominantly based on green electricity, and Siemens intends to be the company delivering all of that and has definitely put their money where their mouth is. It's not cheap to run basically a year-round trade show on the Thames in London for people to come and hand out awards and that kind of thing. And what it gets to, and by the way, they're doing huge projects as well. I mean, Siemens is not as well known here, but Siemens does everything from, you know, build LRT systems to build the software systems and sensors and the rest of it that London uses for its congestion charging. Siemens is doing several massive rail projects in London, sort of running rail lines. Imagine how complicated it must be. There's a lot of engineers in this room, you know, building modern rail rail infrastructure is hard enough. Imagine doing it through the middle of the city of London, which is one of the things that Siemens is doing right now, not getting in the way of all of this booming banking economy and the rest of it. Just to look at one example that I think might have some lessons for Montreal, especially of one of the cities that won one of these C40 awards, was the city of Bogota. And Bogota is in the process, having already kind of blazed the trail for cheap, efficient, easily deployable transportation in a developing world city with bus rapid transit, BRT. Bogota's seen, along with a couple of others, as kind of the progenitor of that BRT model. What they're now doing, and this is an interesting thing, this is what they won their award for, is they've decided that they have this unique problem in Colombia that the vast majority of their power is hydroelectric, and it's really, really cheap. And it's a nice problem to have, and it's the same sort of problem, actually, that I would argue Quebec has, and a number of Canadian provinces do. And what they've decided is, you know, the way to go, one of the ways to go anyway, is rather than, you know, trying to slightly reduce the emissions of the vehicle fleet, what if we had an electric fleet of vehicles using that cheap energy, and it's, you know, it's emissions-free through the entire life cycle of the thing. And interesting thing, and just as a side note, one of the problems they're running into, the city of Bogota, they're ready to you know, basically start tendering orders for these electric buses, and no one's making electric buses, pure electric buses, in the numbers that they think they might need. And there is an engineering design problem and a market waiting to be served. And there are certainly companies that are racing to meet that need. So the last piece of this puzzle, which gets to the real value proposition that I think we are of this new era of cities that we are entering into, comes from how we make and distribute the energy we have. And our current model, and a lot of the assumptions under which we have these kind of really, really dark scenarios 50 years out, assume that model basically survives, that we've got a lot of big, centralized power plants, that those power plants are predominantly fossil fuel driven, and then we have to push the electricity out to the people. And There are economies that have already begun going other ways and have found that the problems from breaking sharply against that model are actually turning into opportunities. And so we're going to finish this tour in Denmark. And we're in Denmark because Denmark has among the highest per capita wind consumption in the world. More than 25% of the Danish grid is now wind-powered, and their goal as a country is to see 50% of their grid coming from the wind by 2025 or thereabouts. And when the Danish government set this goal, it quickly realized that its grid could not possibly service 50% wind. For the obvious reason, which many people like to talk about as an insoluble problem, that the wind does not blow all the time, nor predictably, and that therefore you need to figure out some way to store the wind energy when it's cheap to make so that you can service this sort of functioning industrial economy. And when the Danes looked at this, they got the Danish Technical University and the Danish Energy Agency, and eventually a handful of companies like IBM and Siemens and a few others got involved. And they realized that you weren't going to be able to solve this in the near term if you had standalone storage of any sort. There just wasn't an economical way to do standalone storage. And what they realized, though, is if you assume that there's this vast distributed battery system, and what they thought was imagine 100,000 electric vehicles on the road by 2025, then what would that solution look like? And they're now in the process of building that at scale on the island of Bornholm. And the island of Bornholm, this is what it looks like. It's a tourist and agricultural economy, very pretty little area. The reason it was picked is because they've already got nearly 50% of their grid from wind, and they didn't want to do just sort of a simulation. They wanted to actually build it on the ground. This is sort of the rough rough design that they were hoping for going in. So you've got wind power. Wind, of course, is often blows strongest at night. So you've got cheap wind power fueling cars that are sitting in garages during the day. Those people then go to work, plug back into the grid, and broker back with the grid using a whole suite of smart energy technology to feed the power where it's needed during the day. And this has been, I've been following this project for about 7 years now, talking to the people who are doing it. And the only problem they have run into from a technical standpoint is that there simply aren't enough electric vehicles yet being manufactured to do that piece of it. Not that they haven't done everything else. And I do want to underscore this. This is up and running now in Bornholm. Basically, they kind of flipped the switch last October. There are now 1,900 homes with these with all this suite of smart grid technologies you see on the bottom. They did bring in a handful of electric vehicles just to show that design-wise it would work, that you could, in fact, fuel an electric vehicle and then use it as a stored battery. In the meantime, they continue to run into interesting new opportunities, though. One of the things they discovered, this is on the largest town in Bornholm, Rona. They built this little, it's basically a typical Danish home that they've completely retrofitted with all of the smart grid technology so that they can show people this is what we're talking about doing. It works. And there's all kinds of amazing stuff. Certainly if anyone wants to talk afterward, I'm happy to, about the engineering specifications of it. They're looking at energy pricing and energy demand and supply in 5-minute increments in real time. So what that means is things like, say, your refrigerator, if it was plugged into one of these smart grid plugs, it would be able, you don't care when it does its refrigeration. You only care that it keeps things cold. So what if before kicking on the compressor, the refrigerator checked the spot price of electricity, whether it was rising or falling, and made a decision based on where that was going. They're doing that already with these 1,900 homes. The most interesting thing, actually, about the smart Villa Smart is this thing, which was not in the initial design plans. They intended to use car batteries as their distributed storage system, but when the car batteries weren't there, they had to come up with some other ideas, and one of them was to store the wind energy as heat to heat the houses and cool the houses during the day. So what you're looking at there, which looks kind of like a furnace, is basically a stored furnace using stored heat to heat the house. So and the other thing they've realized, and I will confess, because I'm not an engineer, I still don't fully understand this, but the engineer who explained it to me was really excited about it. Is that they realized that there were some functions that grid management used to, some of the most expensive things about, kind of load balancing and this kind of stuff, that they used to have to do centrally command and control, they can now actually do with this distributed system basically for free, because it's just, you can just sort of offload these little bits of energy when you need to. Again, as I said, I don't fully understand the engineering of it, but what it meant was that they discovered not only that this stuff works, but that there was a huge cost savings involved. in some places, and certainly in you know from a complication point of view, they found that there were opportunities in there that they hadn't recognized going in. And so what this brings us to, and this is my sort of final pitch, is the value proposition for the urban homeowner, the urban resident of tomorrow. I'm going to put this 10 years out, 2023. By 2023, I quite firmly believe it will certainly be possible in parts of Denmark and maybe beyond to live in this kind of configuration wherever it is you live. These are the three pieces of it. First, you've got a house that was, not all of them, but some of them, generating some of its own power. In this particular case, these houses, this is a neighborhood outside of Freiburg in Germany, obviously using solar power. Every single one of these, this is a townhouse community of 58, every single one of these actually makes more power than it uses over the course of a year because it was built hyper-efficiently from the ground up, and then there was an oversized solar array put on each one. So it actually generates net negative carbon footprint, I guess you could say, and on top of that is quite lucrative for the people who live in it. Let's just say near net zero is certainly going to be part of that future, and maybe we'll even go beyond in some cases. You're living in a much more efficient home because you've got these smart grid technologies that are meaning for the first time. You're not using technology that Edison himself would have recognized to track your own power usage. You don't just have a meter that spins. You're able to actually go back and forth, decide what to do and when. You can certainly imagine it integrating really well with a suite of apps, some of which already exist, to do things like, you know, your washer or dryer or dishwasher could query you, hey, now looks like a good time to come on. Should I go on now? And you could make those decisions remotely and that sort of thing. And then the third piece, and this kind of gets to why I'm bullish enough on this to say it's 10 years off, is that even though the electric vehicles aren't there yet, we are already seeing stuff that nobody saw 10 years ago, things like the Tesla Model S. And that actually brings me full circle, because I first encountered the idea of electric vehicles 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, in Montreal, at an electric vehicle show where they had us out at the racetrack looking at, I was covering it for Time Magazine, and they had us out trying out all these sort of next generation electric cars and various other sort of low carbon cars. And you know, the prototype of the Nissan Leaf was there, the prototype of the Toyota Prius. Ford had this hydrogen powered car that spat clean water out its tailpipe, and that was really kind of the star of the show because we were 10 years from hydrogen economy at that point. Turns out not. That isn't the way we've gone to date. But the reason I mention that is because nobody at this kind of next generation car show 10 years off was standing around saying, you know what's actually going to happen is some dot-com billionaire is going to start a company from scratch and build one of the highest performing cars on the road that just happens to be all electric. And I'm willing to bank on the idea that the value proposition has gotten so much better that people are going to want to be able to plug their car in at night, get energy cheapest when there's not a lot of demand, drive to work if they have to drive to work, plug it back in, and broker back that energy to the grid when the grid needs it. And I'm willing to bet that value proposition, that story of where we could be, combined with some of the stuff we've talked about what a vibrant, sustainable city looks like, is going to be so attractive that a whole bunch of stuff that currently looks like a giant mountain of a problem is going to increasingly look like our brightest possible future, and that's where we're going to want to get to by any means necessary, best and the brightest tasked at it. It is a very, very tall order. It is a long road, but the great thing about it is already, you know, 10 years from the first time I laid sight on an electric vehicle, we're already at a point where stuff nobody could have imagined then is already happening, at least on one island in Denmark. So that really is the nature of a leap. It takes you to a place you don't really expect it's going to until you get there, but generally speaking, it lands you someplace much better than we are today. I invite you to check out my website, theleapworks.com. I'd love to hear from you, either by Twitter or by email, because I want to know, you know, what are your stories? Where do you want to go? There's way more expertise in this room on all of the stuff I've talked about than I personally possess. So please do feel free to be in touch. And again, thank you all for your time and for having me here this evening.